Be seated. Ms. Dalton, if you'll give us a minute till the doors are shut. Officer, are we good? Ms. Dalton, you can go.
If I could please reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And may it please the court, on behalf of Charles Lamar Sharp, our first argument is that there was not sufficient evidence to convict Sharp of identity theft where the Commonwealth failed to prove that he used a false identity to avoid summons, arrest, prosecution, or to impede a criminal investigation. The identity theft statute prohibits the use of a false ID only to avoid summons, arrest, prosecution, or to impede a criminal investigation. And in this case, the facts related to the identity theft charge were that Sharp initially, when approached by Officer Hager and asked his name, gave the name DeMontre Smith. When the officer accused him of giving a false name, Sharp predominantly didn't speak to the officer again, except when he was being handcuffed and asked again what his name was, and he told the officer his name was Handcuffs. In this case, the only evidence that Sharp had an outstanding warrant was not offered for the truth of the matter asserted by the Commonwealth. Also, Officer Hager testified that during this interaction, he did not tell Sharp about the warrant or that he was being investigated, and that he did not tell him that he was being arrested. Officer Hager also testified that the initial encounter was consensual, that Sharp was free not to answer his questions, and there was no problem with the fact that Sharp refused to speak to him. There was no evidence in this case that Sharp knew he had an outstanding warrant or that he knew he was being investigated. It's a reasonable inference that Sharp initially gave the wrong name just to avoid basically dealing with the officer.
Counsel, didn't the trial court reject that hypothesis of innocence?
I don't think that he explicitly rejected it. I think that it was argued that basically, Sharp was being a smart aleck, and the court found, I think, primarily dismissed the Handcuffs name and focused on the DeMontre Smith name, but I don't think he explicitly found that he was not being a smart aleck or not being, I guess, just difficult with the officer.
Well, given the fact that the officer said that's the exact same name you gave me 5 years ago when I asked you what your name was, and you said DeMontre Smith, isn't that more than being a smart aleck? That's essentially trying to tell the officer, I'm somebody he just didn't remember. Presumably he told this officer that same name 5 years ago.
I'm not sure I understand the court.
Well, if you're indicating that you think your argument is that by saying DeMontre Smith, he was being a smart aleck. Well, 5 years ago, the officer testified, you told me the same thing 5 years ago, so I, of course, don't believe you now. Why is that being a smart aleck?
Well, I think that's exactly why it's being a smart aleck.
But it's 5 years interlude in there.
Right, but given their history, and given that that's the same name that he gave before, that it's a reasonable inference that Sharp thought the officer knew who he was, and that knew he's not DeMontre Smith, and that he was just making the officer's job more difficult, or that... I guess
he's responding. That if it were like 5 days ago, years ago.
I understand that the interlude makes it a little bit less clear. With respect to the second argument on venue, our argument is that there was not sufficient evidence to prove venue, or the evidence did not establish a strong presumption that the offense occurred in the city of Richmond. And this court reviews a venue challenged de novo because it's a mixed question of law and fact. With respect to venue, the sole evidence was through Officer Hager's testimony, and Officer Hager testified that he observed Sharp initially walking his dog on the 1700 block of Clarkson Road, and that Sharp continued to walk his dog as Hager waited for backing units before approaching him. After additional units arrived, Hager drove to where Sharp was walking at that point and approached him on foot. Nothing in Officer Hager's testimony indicated how far Sharp walked how long he waited for the backing units, how long Officer Hager waited for the backing units.
And Counsel, at this juncture, how do we review those facts? What is the situation in terms of the light most favorable to the Commonwealth?
Well, I think even in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, we basically have two facts as to venue, and that's that Sharp is walking the dog initially at the 1700 block of Clarkson Road, and that he moves some distance during some period of time, and that the only additional evidence of the location of that second location is that when Officer Hager approaches him, that it was near a fence that belongs to Southwood Properties.
And there's absolutely no discussion of where Southwood Properties is.
Right. There's no discussion that the 1700 block of Clarkson Road, there's no testimony, I guess, by the officer that the 1700 block of Clarkson Road is in the city of Richmond. There's no testimony that Southwood Properties, in particular, a fence belonging to Southwood Properties, is located in the city of Richmond. And then the argument and discussion that goes on is just with respect to the 1700 block of Clarkson Road.
How do you respond to the Commonwealth's point that there's some missing pieces in the record that would be on appeal, the defendant's obligation?
And it certainly is the appellant's obligation to complete the record. I just wanted the only indication that anything is missing is the one portion on page 31 of the joint appendix where the court is speaking and the first part of the court's sentence is noted as inaudible. There are, I believe, two indications on page 27 and page 31 where the court reporter makes a note that that the court and defense counsel are talking simultaneously. Not that any portion of it is inaudible or that she was unable to transcribe that portion. I think it's just meant to indicate that these two things are being said at the same time. that would be my response to the Commonwealth's argument that there's a missing portion of the transcript. As to the issue of judicial notice.
Before we move on to that, let me ask you one other question about what is the effect of trial counsel's argument, particularly the defense attorney's argument to the trial judge about Chesterfield versus Richmond. Is that an admission that it's in Richmond?
I don't believe it is. I think that defense counsel doesn't concede, as the Commonwealth position argues, that the Commonwealth had proven venue. She just argued that Clarkson Road may be in Chesterfield County, as her understanding was that Clarkson Road is somewhere on the border. However, at most, I would argue that she conceded that part of Clarkson Road is in the city of Richmond, not all of it.
Did she concede that the Southwood apartments or properties are on Clarkson Road?
No, I don't think there was any discussion or concession about where Southwood Properties is located. Although the trial court can take judicial notice of geographical facts, they need to be matters that are common knowledge or shown by maps in common use. And in this case, the Commonwealth did not argue that the location of the initial interaction, the 1700 block of Clarkson Road, or the second interaction somewhere near a fence at Southwood Properties was a matter of common knowledge. The Commonwealth did not ask the trial court to take judicial notice that the address was located in the city of Richmond by reference to a map. And the trial court, most importantly, did not state that it was familiar with that location, either location, or that it was taking judicial notice of the location.
Well, what do you make, though, of, to follow up on Judge Decker's question, when trial counsel says, I do not know if Clarkson Road also runs into Chesterfield County, implication being it's certainly part of it's in the city of Richmond.
Sure.
I do know that Clarkson Road is in a place in the city that is close to the Chesterfield County line. So I do not know if it runs into Chesterfield County or not. I don't know if that is something that the court is willing to do. That sounds like judicial notice. Of course, I would ask that the court do not do that, but that, of course, is up to the court.
I think certainly the Commonwealth takes a position, and the court may find that that was a reference to judicial notice, although it's not clear. My response to that would be that the court even if defense counsel says, I know 1700 block of Clarkson Road is in the city of Richmond, and the court can take judicial notice of that fact, that is not evidenced by the Commonwealth, and it's not showing that the court then did take judicial notice. It would be different if the court had said that, or if the court, based on counsel's concession that part of Clarkson Road is in the city of Richmond, had said, yes, I'm familiar with it, or yes, I'm taking judicial notice, if we all agree that that's where that location is located. So I think that it could have been conceded in its entirety. It could have been, the court could have taken judicial notice whether or not the Commonwealth or defense counsel knew where Clarkson Road is. The court could have said, I know where Clarkson Road is, and I take judicial notice that it's in the city of Richmond. Or if the Commonwealth had, or the court by reference to a map, had said, well, let's look up at where Clarkson Road is, I take judicial notice of this map, or that I think it's a matter of common knowledge where Clarkson Road is, and taking judicial notice of that.
Counsel, let me just interrupt you. I failed to ask you if you wanted to reserve any time for rebuttal.
5 minutes. I think I'm into it, Your Honor, so I will wait and respond. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll give you the 5 minutes, Counsel.
Thank you.
Ms. Johnson.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm Victoria Johnson. I'm here on behalf of the Commonwealth. To start with briefly the evidence for intent, the sufficiency of the evidence, as this court knows, intent is a factual matter. This court is bound by factual findings of the trial court and a bench trial unless those factual findings are not supported by the evidence or are plainly wrong. Here, I submit that there is adequate evidence to support the trial court's finding that Mr. Sharp gave a false name with the intent to avoid a summons and arrest or to impede an investigation.
How do you get to intent? Tell us how you get to intent.
I think that you look at the entirety of the circumstances and that you look at the defendant's actions, which is how we usually get to intent here.
But under these facts,
how do you
get to intent?
Certainly, Your Honor. As was mentioned in prior argument, we know from the context of this case that the officer knew Sharp from previous interactions. So that gives us some information that Sharp was known to the police. Sharp knew the police as well, so he's not going into this blind. We also know that when the officer approached Sharp, Sharp gave him the same false name that he had given him 5 years previously. We also know that Sharp had a tendency to flee when he was approached by law enforcement, which is why the officer called for backup. We also know that when the officer approached Sharp, he did, in fact, flee a little bit. He went behind this fence that was owned by Southwood Properties and stayed there and gave the false name, refused to give any other information, in fact, refused to give any information throughout the booking process and when he was before the magistrate, as I recall. I think taking all of these circumstances together, it was entirely reasonable for the trial court to find that Mr. Sharp intended to avoid arrest or to impede the investigation.
But where in all of that is any evidence that would give rise to Sharp knowing that there was any investigation going on?
I believe that when he was approached by the officer, you can reasonably infer that he knew when he avoided the officer that he knew that he was being investigated for his criminal conduct.
Based on what factors?
That he immediately gave the same false name that he had given 5 years prior, that he attempted to evade the officer by hopping behind the fence, and that he continued to refuse to give any information to the officer after he was detained and arrested.
So were you seeking to criminalize lying to the police?
Certainly not, Your Honor. I think that based on the plain language of the statute, that the statute criminalizes giving a false name to avoid summons, arrest, prosecution, or to impede a criminal investigation.
But you've got to know there's a criminal investigation to impede it, don't you?
Yes, Your Honor. That is correct.
What is the evidence that he knew of a criminal investigation? Just that he gave the same false name that he gave 5 years ago?
and he refused to give any further information to the officers, and he evaded the officers as they approached.
But if the officer doesn't make it in any way, shape, or form clear that he's investigating a matter, what difference does it make if somebody gives a false name and doesn't want to interact with the officer on what's otherwise a consensual encounter?
I think that's a fact-by-fact basis, Your Honor. I think that here we have sufficient evidence to show that the officer believed that the defendant had an outstanding warrant.
But he didn't communicate to the
defendant. He did not communicate that to the defendant. There's nothing in the record that states that the officer approached the defendant and said, I'm here to arrest you. Hey, Mr. Sharp.
Do you have any outstanding
charges? Nothing like that. So that was not communicated to the defendant. That's correct. There's nothing in the record to say that.
What evidence is there that the officer did anything that would otherwise communicate, whether through words or through deeds, to Mr. Sharp that he was conducting an investigation? Aside from what's your name?
Respectfully, I think that the court is looking for direct evidence, somewhat direct evidence of intent here. And
before even getting to the intent, what evidence is there circumstantially or directly that the officer communicated to Sharp that he was conducting an investigation?
The
Aside
officer,
from asking his name.
That's it. That is what is in the record. The officer approached the defendant. It's pretty plain on the record that the officer believed that Mr. Sharp had an outstanding warrant. He recognized Mr. Sharp from the previous interactions. He saw Mr. Sharp.
No question that the officer.
Right, and I understand that.
He was going to conduct an investigation. Mm-hmm.
He recognized Mr. Sharp. When he approached Mr. Sharp, he said, "Hey, what's your name?" And Mr. Sharp answered, "Demontre Smith." And the officer said, "That's the same fake name you gave me 5 years ago." And if I'm recalling the
Did he say that to
correctly.
The defendant?
Yes, Your Honor. That was his testimony.
After the defendant gave the name?
Yes, Your Honor. And at that point, the defendant attempted to evade by hopping behind for lack of a better phrase. Maybe I'm using the wrong word. Attempted to escape the officers.
What was he escaping at that point in time? A conversation that appears to be a consensual encounter?
I submit that the reasonable inference from those facts is that he was And the inference drawn by the fact finder in this case from those facts is that he was not escaping from a consensual encounter, but was escaping from arrest, prosecution, or a criminal investigation. I think that it is entirely reasonable on these facts in this case that the fact finder concluded that Mr. Sharp was aware of his outstanding warrant and was seeking to avoid being arrested for it.
Was he arrested on an outstanding warrant? Do we have any evidence of that outstanding warrant in this record whatsoever?
No, Your Honor, we do not. We have the officer's belief that...
So the officer's belief that he does not communicate to the defendant and an outstanding warrant that appears in this record in no way, shape, or form, just that we're supposed to assume the defendant knew of when he's asked his name.
Respectfully, Your Honor, no, this court is not supposed to assume that. This court is supposed to look at the facts established in the record and determine whether they were sufficient evidence to support the trial court's factual finding. This court is not to reweigh the evidence. Instead, this court is to look at the facts as found by the fact finder and determine whether they were sufficient evidence to support this conviction, and I submit that they were.
But you have to presume knowledge on the part of the defendant that was not communicated to him to get to that conclusion, correct?
Your Honor, I believe that is a consistently reasonable inference from the defendant's actions that he knew that he had an outstanding warrant. And those actions included giving a false name, trying to escape from the officers by hopping through this gate with his pit bull dog, and refusing to speak to the officers throughout this interaction. It's pretty plain that the defendant knew that he was in trouble. He had a history with law enforcement. When he was detained and placed in handcuffs, he said, "My name is Handcuffs because you put me in handcuffs." You know, he had this ongoing...
Which the trier of fact found that the handcuff thing was just smart aleck.
It is just smart aleck behavior, but I think it kind of goes to his overall avoidance of law enforcement in this situation, and I understand that it's not a crime to avoid law enforcement, but I think that the trial court made an entirely reasonable inference from these facts And that's my position on the intent.
Can I ask you on the venue?
Yes, Your Honor.
We have testimony that he was walking his dog in the 1700 block of Clarkson Road.
Yes, sir.
But we don't know exactly. We know where he ended up in front of those apartments. Mm-hmm. We don't know what street they're on, do we?
No, Your Honor. There was no evidence presented as to where those apartments are. We know about Clarkson Road. And the...
Well, I think you probably know where my next question is.
Yes.
And that is, given the Supreme Court's recent decision in Williams, where the Commonwealth actually asked the court to take judicial notice, mm-hmm. and here the Commonwealth did not, you almost have, it seems, a preference by defense counsel where you could take judicial notice. You could read it that way, but I ask you not to. But not an absolute concession that all of Clarkson Road is in the city of Richmond either. Given that we don't know where these apartments are, or they're on Clarkson Road, how can, under Williams, we decide that venue is proper here?
And I foresaw this question coming, Judge Bielsa, and I tried to address that in my brief as much as I could. I submit that this case is distinct from Williams for a number of reasons. First, we have that discussion with defense counsel making a factual concession that Clarkson Road is within the city of Richmond. So we know about that. We also, so the defendant was heard on the issue of venue, and that was something that was very important, I submit, to the Supreme Court in the Williams case, because, you know, there it was almost like the defense was kind of a little surprised by the venue situation.
But there they talked about, well, you know, we did this on this street, and then we went over there.
Mm-hmm.
And here we're almost going over there for the walking of the dog, or down there. So isn't it a very similar situation?
It is somewhat similar, Your Honor. And
counsel, in a lot of ways, this is worse from a venue perspective than Williams, because here we don't even have the Commonwealth asking the court to take judicial notice.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I submit that in order to get there, we would have to speculate, because I maintain that the transcript is not clear. Looking at appendix at 31, right when the second half of the page, right about line 16, it's right when the court and the parties are discussing the venue issue. The court says something inaudible to where the street is. And I don't know what inaudible is. I don't know if he's saying, do we know where Southwood properties are to the street? You know, I have no idea what that is.
But
I don't
know
what
the response is.
The response is, Ms. Mosby says, I believe that he did give the address to the court. And before that, at this point, Ms. Mosby and the court are speaking simultaneously. And then we have this conversation about, I would ask the court, do not do that, but of course it is up to the court, skipping over to page 32. It appears that there is something missing in
right.
this conversation.
Right, so bear with me for a second.
Certainly,
so we
Your
have
Honor.
Two issues with regard to venue. One is there sufficient evidence to prove venue? The other is, did the judge take judicial notice?
Yes, Your Honor.
One and then the other.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it just as reasonable to say that, based on this record, they were having a discussion about the sufficiency of proof of venue?
Your Honor, I respectfully submit that that is speculative. I am here defending a presumptively valid judgment, and the burden is on the appellant to show trial court error. And the appellant has the burden to provide a record.
And appellant, the court's language, it has been proved to my satisfaction.
It has been
militate in favor of sufficiency rather than taking a judicial notice.
I thought about that, Your Honor. Possibly, yes. I think that dispensing, technically taking judicial notice dispenses with proof. Looking at the conversation on Appendix 32, it appears that the parties are discussing taking judicial notice.
Or are they discussing whether the evidence is sufficient to support venue? And isn't it the Commonwealth's burden below? I mean, Williams makes it pretty clear that the Commonwealth has to get the judge to take judicial notice if they want the judge to take judicial notice.
Yes, Your Honor, that's
correct. And where in the record is the Commonwealth saying to the court, Your Honor, we'd like you to take judicial notice, or words to that effect, because you don't have to say the magic word judicial notice, but you have to make it clear that you're asking the court to take judicial notice.
Well, here it does not appear that the Commonwealth asked the court to take judicial notice unless something happened during that inaudible part, or the part where the court and Ms. Mosby are speaking simultaneously and we don't know what was said. Because I really don't know what was said. It appears in context between pages 31 and 32 that there is something missing from the conversation. I don't think I'm being unreasonable in saying that. It doesn't look like the Commonwealth asked for judicial notice to be taken. It looks like the court may have raised that sua sponte, perhaps, and the court and defense were discussing that. But I submit that on this record, that's somewhat speculative, Your Honor. And I'm sorry, I don't have a better answer.
Well, you've got your record.
The record is what the record is. And I do feel that there is something missing between pages 31 and 32. And I don't mean to sound like kind of a dummy by saying that repeatedly, but it does seem like there's a chunk of argument missing there.
Well, I can try to give it another shot.
Okay,
Do either of the judges have any questions?
No further questions.
Thank you very much.
All right. We'll go ahead and give you 5 minutes, Ms. Hall.
Thank you. With respect to the sufficiency issue, it's not just that there was not evidence that the officer communicated that he was doing an investigation or trying to determine if Mr. Sharp had an outstanding warrant. The officer explicitly testified, I believe in cross-examination, that he did not tell Sharp that he was under investigation. He did not tell Sharp that he had an outstanding warrant or may have an outstanding warrant, and that he did not tell Sharp that he was possibly being arrested.
What about the fact that Sharp used the same false name that he used 5 years previously when the officer ended up having to run after him and Sharp fled?
I'm not sure it would suggest that Sharp knew that he had an outstanding warrant or that he was being investigated.
Maybe that he just always tells the police his name is DeMontre Smith.
Perhaps, Your Honor.
At this juncture, I guess the question is, giving, you know, the proper standard of appellate review, how do we take that?
The
fact that he gave the same false name and that the officer testified that when he did it 5 years ago, he ran. And
I don't really know how to tell the court what. I don't know how to take it. I don't know how the court should take it. But I would just refer the court to the fact that there was no indication that the officer communicated what he was doing. The officer explicitly denied that. And that it's not in evidence that Sharp had an outstanding warrant because, not for the truth of the matter asserted, rather.
When you look at the totality of the circumstances, Ms. Dalton, I mean, he does sort of jump behind that gate, and they're trying to pull him out, and he won't let go or let him through the gate. And then he seems to, at least to some degree, resist arrest, right?
Sure.
Does that not indicate he knows they have a reason they've come for him?
Your Honor, respectfully, I don't think it does. I think there was some indication that he initially stepped behind the fence related to the pit bull, not for any other reason. And then I do think he physically sort of resists being...
Oh, you mean that he's worried the pit bull might attack the officer?
Right, that he put the pit bull behind the fence. But that he does, I guess, physically resist being handcuffed. But that's not... That's, I guess, after he's given the name. It's not related to that. He's then being arrested and basically refuses to speak to the officer except for the comment about the handcuffs.
And he doesn't have to speak to the officers, of course.
Right, and the officer even agrees with that, basically, that he doesn't have to speak to me. It's not a problem that he doesn't want to speak to me, although the officer's understandably frustrated at Sharp's lack of cooperation.
But basically, I mean, the three things that I was asking about are, he says DeMontre Smith, which he said 5 years ago. He jumps behind the gate and pulls the gate shut so the officers can't get to him. And then when they are trying to pull him out, he resists the arrest or resists the handcuff.
Sure. And I would just point out that that's different than him actually running away or something like that. But with respect to the sufficiency, my argument is that there's insufficient evidence that his intent was to avoid apprehension or investigation. And if Sharp gave a false name for any reason other than to avoid someone's arrest or prosecution or to impede a criminal investigation, then the act does not constitute identity theft under the statute. If I could briefly switch to the venue issue, I would argue that the Williams case from 2015 in the Supreme Court of Virginia controls here. And as your honors have noted, in Williams, there was more evidence of venue. The Commonwealth asked the court to take judicial notice in Williams, and the actual evidence of venue in Williams, there was, similar to this case, the two locations where they're at one location and they move to a different location. But in Williams, the initial location, the officer actually testified, was in the city of Norfolk, whereas here there's no evidence that either location was in the city of Richmond. And with this issue of judicial notice, I just again point out that the fact of judicial notice must appear from the record. And in this case, the statements of the trial court do not clearly demonstrate that the court had taken judicial notice.
Was the judge asked to take judicial notice?
No. The word judicial notice does not appear in the
transcript. Well, was the judge asked to take the effect of judicial notice?
I would argue that he was not, but even if he was, that he then did not do so, and that's what matters.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.